California mainly, and maybe a brief foray into northern New Mexico, another great community. Just want to introduce the people who are speaking here today. On my far right is Ramon Sender Barayan, who is, well, like I mentioned him in my remarks yesterday, has all kinds of anarchist and communist and communal connection from his own personal past. Was the first resident of Morningstar Ranch, 1966, one of the early California communes. And went on to Wheeler Ranch and other things. Next to him, Dion De Moon, who has a long communal history, and I think one that's basically still going, right? Still living there. Also in Sonoma County, California. Artie Kopecky lived communally in California and then went on to New Buffalo, and you've seen his books on New Buffalo here. One of the people who really insightfully kept a journal during those days. Can you imagine actually writing it down? Anyway, it's wonderful. We have his primary work, and we'll have his experiences as well. And Alicia Bay Laurel, whom you heard so wonderfully last night, lived at Wheeler's Ranch and then has been all over the world since then. That's an amazing array of experiences as well. So we don't have any real agenda here. If any of you want to say something by way of opening, you can, or we can just go.
Oh, I thought I might start by playing a little bit of my doctoral dissertation. I imagine writing a doctoral dissertation on hippies, but anyway, I'll let it speak for itself. It's more interesting.
Well, we should also add that we're trying to find a time to show the whole DVD at some point today. And it'll probably be sometime, obviously, after lunch. But we'll announce it where and when for those of you who might be interested in viewing the whole thing. But right now, we're just going to give a brief excerpt. A teaser.
Oh, could we interrupt and make a couple of announcements?
Sure.
Is
breakfast tomorrow the
same? Yet still surviving in California. Of four counterculture communities and a land that drew them together, unfolding from within and around each other in kaleidoscopic fashion, so that one cannot rightly say where one began and another ended, even though they are discrete entities.
That's us.
They are like cousins. And cousin-like also is their relationship to other communities around them. Interrelational, bonded, yet unique. They touch upon each other in ways not always material that deepen each. The communal story, weaving an imagination of past, present, and future. A communal memoir.
In our own lives. We want to believe in the story of us as individuals and us as our invented family.
I lived here at Wheeler's Ranch when I was 18 years old. And like 71 or 70, I don't even remember anymore.
And when I met him when I was about 7 or 8, I realized he was a cousin to me just because of these kind of free world ideas that we were kind of raised with.
This was home to me. I never ride a car down in. I always walk because it's the walk into home. And this was my only home, as far as I'm convinced, other than the earth itself, and far beyond my own blood family. Wheeler's was my home. I was welcomed here. I was a homeless teen. I was shown unconditional love.
People come back and they say, "You saved my life."
It's Bill Wheeler.
You know, I was lost before I came here. This showed me the way. A lot of people like that.
May Day is when everybody comes together, all the old, all the new, and we all bring new people, and we all, you know, it's the time and space where the past and the present meet.
Well, the Morning Star survives and the changes that followed it.
Still a very holy piece of land, I think, which, and that holiness, of course, can be ascribed to any land which has people who love it. But there's something about Morning Stars, for me at least, quite unique. And I like the fact that it's going back to nature.
I think it was an experience, whether it didn't last, unfortunately.
When things were happening there at Morning Star, Larry and I both found it really interesting, and I liked that there was, I liked that relaxation. I liked everyone sitting out in the sunshine on the hillside doing yoga, and I liked people walking out around with no clothes on. And I mean, this was all very fresh and new, you know. And I thought that, and people just opening his land like that, and people coming on there and just building these little shelters, you know, all these little experiments, building up in the trees and building, you know, out of grass or whatever, you know. I mean, it was just
anyway, you want to see more? We'll do some more later. Now, that Mary, who you saw last speaking, was an absolutely wonderful person. I remember her because her husband, Larry, joined us at Wheeler's one summer, and he built the most unique structure, from my point of view, that I'd ever seen. He came up with a 30-foot section of construction plastic and some redwood bender board, and he sandwiched the plastic between these strips of bender board. Then he got some friends, and we just went swoosh, and the whole thing just went up in the air like this, and it was in a redwood grove. So you had the semi-shade and the clear plastic, and then they threw a couple carpets in it and some pillows, and he had his summer home. And I just thought it was a great idea, just a great idea, because you were almost living outside. But anyway, so welcome, and I don't know, anyone else want to comment on Delia's film before we go on?
No, I think we just let it grow, the conversation grow organically. Yeah.
Well, just, I know nothing about this period. Is Wheeler Ranch and Morning Star the same thing, or are we talking about two different communities?
We're talking about two different communities.
Okay.
But a lot of times
with
the same
lot of
people.
Overlap. Yeah, a lot of overlap. Yeah.
Can you all speak up, too? So everybody
these houses that people build by themselves, which... I believe everyone should have the right to build their own house. Of course, it's very illegal according to the common structure of the mainstream society, and so people got into trouble at Morning Star for building these kind of houses and having a different kind of concept of personal hygiene and ways of dressing or undressing in public, and so Morning Star was closed down, and a lot of people went to Wheeler. Bill Wheeler opened up his ranch. He was an artist from Connecticut, quite wealthy, and he bought this piece of land. He and his wife settled down, and suddenly he was providing home to 250 hippies or more. Wow.
As people got arrested at Morning Star, they could get out of jail by promising the judge not to go back. And it was at that point that Bill Wheeler opened his land to those, well, to anyone, but those who first settled it were those who could not go back to Morning Star, and so they went to Wheeler's.
The beginning of this cycle was the Diggers in San Francisco. The Diggers started out as the street theater group, the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and they decided that they were going to feed and clothe and house all the people that came for the Summer of Love in 1967. So they started the free stores, the free clinics, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the Panhandle in Golden Gate Park. They were giving away free food. So they approached Lou Gottlieb from the Limelighters because he had the 30 acres up in Sonoma County and said, can we come up to your land and grow fruits and vegetables to give away at our feeding in the park? And he said, of course. And they came to garden there. Now, Ramon, you were living there before that, before the diggers came?
Yeah.
But when they came, they already had this concept of everything belongs to everyone, that the commons was really global. And they said to Lou, your land belongs to God. And Lou Gottlieb totally went with that, to the point where there was a moment in court where the judge was saying, it is impossible to deed land to God. God is not a legal entity. And Lou said, what about on the dollar? It says, in God we trust. And the judge said, well, then who's going to pay the land taxes? And he said, I will, for God's sake. Lou was the greatest comedian. And he was never off stage, never even when he was like naked and sitting in a chicken shack where he had his Usendorfer piano. So anyway, all these people came to Morningstar, but the thing that tipped off the heat was when this 15-year-old girl who had eloped from Summer Hill School in New York with her teacher,
and a letter of permission from her mother.
And a letter of permission from her mother, but she came, they were living at Morningstar, and she went to the Clapp Clinic in Santa Rosa. So there was a 15-year-old girl at the Clapp Clinic in Santa Rosa. That was what brought down the heat on Morningstar. And then when the health department, the police, the housing authority, all these different entities all came, rushed in to make this social experiment die. And thank goodness for Bill Wheeler. And then from Bill Wheeler, there were three different directions that it spread. One of them was Delia bought 1,000 acres, one piece of property away to the south, where she founded Bodega Pastures. Peter Myers bought the property adjacent to the north, where he started Center of the Pumpkin. And when I got the money from Living on the Earth, one of the things that I did was I leased the property for a year directly west of Wheeler Ranch and started Star Mountain Condo. I didn't stay. A whole lot of other people came, and eventually Delia's husband, Moses, bought that property from Bill Wheeler and sustained Star Mountain Commune, which is now the property of their daughter, Amanda Moon. Who's a school teacher and doesn't live there.
She lives in Forestville.
You know, but all of these communities continue. All of these communities.
And each one is very unique
yeah.
in its own way, too, I think we should say. And for those of you who really want a full story, there's a 24-chapter history of Morningstar and Wheeler's called Home Free Home. It's not in print, but it's on the internet. And I guess just www.raysender.html will take you to a 24-chapter history of Wheeler's and Morningstar, plus the Morningstar scrapbook, which is all the clippings and photographs I was able to find and put together, which, by the way, the hard copy will go on auction today here. And then also the manifesto, which has Alicia's cover, has many of her drawings in it, and what else is up there? Oh, then I think there's a
Wheeler's,
link.
Wheeler's Manifesto.
Yeah, Wheeler's Manifesto. Yeah.
Manifesto 2.
And Manifesto 2,
yes.
Right. And then there's, a link to 300 black and white photographs of Wheeler Ranch people, plus photos taken by the private guard who the unfriendly front neighbor hired to ID everybody coming through. Because he had to cross his land to get to Wheeler's, and this was a constant source of irritation to him. I don't know why.
I can imagine. But
anyway, but when the guard retired or left, he became quite friendly to us towards the end, And he gave us his whole book of ID photos, which is really quite valuable because on every photo, there's on the back is the name of the person and probably the make of his car and whatever other thing he could get. But it's really quite an interesting record. Plus, it has photographs of the final climactic moment in Wheeler history where Mrs. Kelly, the wife of the front land owner, was knocked down by the gate when Bill Wheeler pushed the gate open with his truck after a great argument about whether or not he could bring a trailer. They had just bulldozed his house, and he had a wife with a little baby, and he was trying to bring a trailer through for them to live in, and Mrs. Kelly wouldn't let him through. So Bill called the cops, and they came out and said, well, all we can do is watch. So Bill pushed the gate open with his truck bumper, and she slammed it back, and it rebounded on her and knocked her to the ground with a hairline fracture of the hip, and Bill was hauled off to the pokey on assault with a deadly weapon, namely his truck, and it was a disaster. It was a true disaster. And at that point, Bill went to live in Bolinas and cool out for a couple of years. But the happy ending is that Mr. Kelly was finally bought out by a friend, and that land is now friendly land, and so it has a happy ending.
That land is now called Ocean Song, and Peter Myers, who owns it, gave a land easement to the Sonoma Land Trust for it to be forever wild, and he lives on part of it, and part of it he leases to, to a group that does weddings and organic gardening and
ecology,
teaches in schools and brings schools up to learn about ecology. So on it goes in different forms maybe, but yeah. Still, Star Mountain and Bodega Pastures are still functioning, and of course it's known that we're there, and also Wheeler sort of very quietly, a little bit happening. But Morningstar just has caretakers who live there. People visit but don't live there. But of course, Sonoma County knows all about us. They've got aerial photos of each and every one of our homes. And at any moment, we're subject to being busted, which is why I can't show this particular film publicly except to friends. Hi, friends.
Hey, I was part of this movement. We lived in Bolinas. We had just a little house in Bolinas. We would just hear a few people talk about Morningstar. People had been there. But I was with a different group and sort of a little bit more Wild West group, maybe more people from the Midwest, although I'm from New York. I was just super impressed how this was in the air. It was a happening thing, and I sure want to try to make that magic somehow reoccur. I am really glad to see here Daniel gave a talk, and Betsy, that there are a lot of pieces of the Echo Villages, the new name for communes in a way, that there is a really current movement, and Daniel's really excited about it, and I am too. I'm hoping my books could possibly play a role, get people excited. It was such a democratic thing, democracy. I mean, we now have, you know, the administration representing and sort of selling, just using democracy as a kind of a cover. There's a huge room for a really democratic movement of showing and trying to create a friendly and caring future. Anyhow, one of the other communes that I was involved with was this Crow Farm, CRO, up near Eugene, Oregon, and there were some people at the university, and we'd certainly like to see that be happening again. People at the university and buying some property and having a bunch of people live out there and doing all the things that you learn on the job. You know, you set up the solar collector to open your gate, but you have some way of inviting people in, making them welcome, and make that make that thing run, and people live in here and there and there. I think if you're really, really contributing, that gets over some of these other problems of authorities being against you. You have to be friendly.
How many people here have lived communally?
Currently?
No, just in the past, ever in your life, you lived communally. I just, yeah, okay.
See, Daniel wants to say something. Oh, okay. Well, this Crow Farm, let me just say another moment or two about that. It was a bunch of people from Minnesota, basically, and in the Midwest, and one of my guys who was so influential with me, Tepe Rochon from Wisconsin. And they had bought 130 acres, and that's, I just really want to see us. You know, we just don't make it till we start to get at that level again and then pick it up where that got left off. Unfortunately, that too didn't. I don't know the full history of it.
Hi, yeah, and this is kind of toward Alicia and kind of toward you. Alicia mentioned last night how you're active now in the online community. Mm-hmm. And how do you see sort of communications technology changes since the movements that you're talking about in the film? And, you know, moving into now how we can get, you know, communities going, how do you see newer technologies kind of taking part in that?
You know, I've been visiting communes. In 2000, I did a drive around the United States, and I visited Lost Valley, Dancing Rabbit, Sand Hill, and Libre during my tour. And I noticed that everybody had the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That not only was it an organ of political organizing, but of course people were buying and selling things on there. It makes cottage industry possible. I mean, I noticed that people that eschew many other forms of 20th century convenience, particularly microwave ovens, are thought of as being evil. But just about everybody has. At least dial-up, you know, and actually, it's more convenient to get DSL when you're way out in the country because, if you don't have a phone line coming in, but you can pick up satellite.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an intentional community on an island in Fiji, on Koro, and that was their big announcement by email last month. We've got DSL now, you know? To me, it's kind of like having a magic carpet and a magic wand, you know, to be able to get onto the net and do things. It's really like a whole new dimension. Even Wheeler Ranch, which has been very Luddite from the beginning, they do have internet connection there. Yeah.
But not everybody, just
no,
a little
just
shack
one.
At the top of the land.
Yeah,
yeah.
In the parking lot. In the parking lot, there's a phone.
A lot of people on fixed incomes don't have internet. I have to use it at the public. I was mentioning last night that the main thing I have at San Francisco State is that's the nearest unlimited time email that's available and near to where I live and. Live, particularly when there's business to take care of, like filing for scholarships to conferences or to writing, sending emails to family members and so on. Unless I'm in a town, in some other place.
The thing that the internet showed me was most visible on February 15th, 2003. When 15 million people protested the upcoming invasion of Iraq on every continent. It was the first time in human history that number of people all rose as one to say something, and that only could have happened as a result of internet connection. And I can only hope that will explode.
Well, before the internet, during the
let's go on with the panel, okay?
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to say, because of course you were all interested in the history, and just from my casual reading, boats traveling to Virginia in the 1700s, someone wrote that you could smell the perfume of the virgin forests from 50 miles offshore. I can't give you the citation, but that. And then I did read a journal by a Reverend Charles Wood Mason, who traveled the backwoods of the Carolinas in the 1700s, and he's mainly complaining about how everybody's running around naked, and women are having children out of wedlock, and it's just shocking the way these people have gone native. And I said, hippies, hippies. This country was founded, at least the certain
Carolinas.
Parts. What I began to realize also is that what allowed Europe to flourish for so many centuries was they could send all their objectionables to the colonies, and they didn't have to tax themselves into insanity by building prisons to hold all these people. They just ship them off. And when America started, if the cops were after you in Philadelphia, you could light out for the frontier to the detriment of Native American living. But we had a built-in safety valve for the first century of our country.
The frontier thesis of Frederick Jackson Turner.
Pardon?
That's basically you're stating the Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis of American.
Oh, is that okay? I know is it seems quite obvious to me that as long as we had that safety valve of frontier territory or outlaw territory, so to speak, civilized and areas did not have to tax themselves building prisons to keep everybody locked up. We didn't agree with them.
Ramon, do you want to talk about your concept of the go-to places?
Oh, yeah, sure.
We have to invent our frontier.
First I have to remember Art Rosenblum, who some of you no doubt fondly met, and who met a tragic early death in a car accident. But Art turned me on to the tribals in India who have children's dormitories where children from the age of 5 up go to spend their daytimes and to sleep. Is that what you want
to
talk about?
No. Oh. Actually not, although that's fascinating too.
Well, that's where
it's right now. I was hoping you would go to the place where you wrote a letter to Willie Brown when he was mayor of San Francisco, and you said that there should be places that were set up.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Do you want to carry
on? Actually, every other year or so, I do write a letter. It's the same letter, kind of saying that one solution to the homeless problem would be to open what I now call timeout camps.
Oh, timeout camps.
It doesn't matter. Or go-tos. It doesn't matter what they're called. But there would be parcels of land with a stack of lumber, a cow, and some chickens where homeless people could go and build their own little house. And the reason there's a cow there is because I always tell people, if you want to start a community, buy a cow. Why? Because then the cow calls the meetings. And one of the problems on our anarchist communes was, if I got up at Wheeler's and said, okay, we're going to have a meeting tonight, everybody said, who the hell do you think you are? You know, and they'd be right, who the hell do I think I am? But if the cow needs to be milked twice a day, and if you want milk for your coffee, you go down to the barn and you hang out and you wait. When the milk is parceled out, you get a little bit to take home. In the meantime, you chat with everybody, you find out the latest that's been going on and what problems might be happening. And it was a very natural, built-in way for people to interrelate without anybody having to be formal about it. I have to laugh when I think of Synanon visited Morningstar in 68. A contingent came and were very friendly and also very invited us to visit. So we returned the favor and came here, and we lasted about a half hour because somebody lit up a joint, and then it became quite apparent that two of the sisters, our sisters, weren't wearing any underwear. So off we were out the front gate within a half hour. But I was also amused by the fact that Synanon was based on encounter and talk. And Morningstar had one meeting in all the years we were there. Also, we had one rule, which was, if you're in a group of people
chatting away, music takes precedence. So anytime you want, if you want to strike up a song, the rappers have to quiet down, and chanting takes precedence over music. So if you want to start up a Hare Krishna, then everybody, that's the happening thing. And it worked quite well. I mean, I can remember many situations where everybody was just talking on and on, you know, about silly stuff, and somebody would start chanting, and the whole vibe would just go whoop, right up about a dimension or two.
You better be careful. Somebody's going to start doing that to us.
Yeah. This gal here would like to say.
I'm approximately the same age as you are. And I was involved in a different kind of movement that we believed was for social change, and that is, you know, like leftist political organizing in urban centers. And what I'd like to ask you is, I think there was a tension in our generation, a contradiction, at least these two big branches, and I'm going to state it real boldly, you know, because I'd like your reaction. Because I was reading Das Kapital and going to study groups and then organizing meetings and all, and I know Alicia said last night she's a child of Bolsheviks,
yes.
So you know what I'm talking about. We had this view that people on communes like yours had withdrawn and isolated yourself and were indulged in, self-indulgent and only interested in personal growth. And we were the righteous people. We were going to bring on the next revolution. And of course, we weren't able to do that. But I'm wondering, did you feel that tension, and how do you respond to it? How did you respond to it then? And how do you feel now, you know, in a self-reflective way? How do you evaluate your activities and the institutions and everything that happened to you?
I'd like to answer your question briefly.
Yeah.
I think that your point is very well taken. And yes, I have felt the conflict. However, I don't think there is a conflict. I think it's just like two wings of the eagle. And I think that, you know, some people educate and talk, and some people live and show example, and that's what I think was happening at the time.
And I'd like to jump in there, too. I think this is extremely important. As a matter of fact, I think that we're sort of in limbo, where it's almost like with a magnet, with the leftist, the Marxist concept of struggle and fighting and also blame, and the other, this more new age Aquarian spiritual idea that we're all God's children, that we're not going to blame that one, which is a really, really hard thing for so many people to do. And I see that, and it's almost that the Echo Village concept is lacking, but I don't think it breaks forth until either some group that's not involved now, like students, or perhaps more of these people who are traditionally left, switch over maybe by seeing the example of the Echo Village, and that just has to take over by its example and its momentum, because I don't think that America is going to move in a big way unless you have a unity movement, something that unifies, even like when Plenty goes to New Orleans and they set up their soup kitchens with the evangelists, find common ground, all these concepts between the Christian and the New Age, and use all those common denominators. You know, you want the Palestinians and Israelis to get together. You want the Sunnis and the Shiites to cooperate. We've got to be able to see the democracy, the free enterprise, and praise America from our standpoint and push our, but we're part of democracy, and not push our movement by saying, man the barricades, raise hell. All these ideas have to do good works. And I think that's where then we become, then we, when we sit at the table with Halliburton and whatnot, where we're going to have face the industrial military complex. I mean, what we want to do is a huge, huge thing and say, okay, Christians, Jews, and Islamists, your God is in all of us. None of you have the one way. I think for us to be at that table there We really need something big, and these two kind of conflicts have to somehow come together and then burst to be big enough to have it.
What do you think, Alicia, as a Bolshevik hippie?
Well, I actually lived in another commune that really was a middle ground, and that was Packer Corners Farm in Vermont. That was founded out of the staff of the Liberation News Service in Washington, D.C. So they were all leftist writers. And the FBI, as it turned out from when the Freedom of Information Act offered access to their files, the FBI burned their building down, infiltrated their organization with people who were posing as leftists, and stole their printing press. And so they all kind of went off to Vermont, where they kind of regrouped and made a rural hippie commune, and at the same time continued to write, continued to participate. So it wasn't really an either or. It was there was a possibility of a both and certainly I saw that in that situation. But the Wheeler Ranch experience that I had in terms of a really amazing social experiment, even though it wasn't thought of that way, I have never in my life lived in a situation where there was a greater diversity of society. Mm-hmm. There were people who were absolutely living on the street with no money at all that came there, and there were the greatest number of people in the East Coast Social Register that I ever met in my life lived at Wheeler Ranch, and everybody in between. And, you know, when everybody takes their clothes off, nobody's got any status symbols on. We were all just human beings with bigger or smaller tits, you know? I mean, that's who we were, you know? So in that sense, I never experienced the ideals to which I continue to ascribe as a leftist than I did during the time that I lived at Wheeler Ranch and really participated in a gift economy as we did there.
You know, you mentioned, Alicia, the diggers coming to Morningstar, and you mentioned the free store and all the free meals, and there were even free automobiles on the street in the hay with a key in it, just a little note that said, please leave some gas in the tank when you're through. But they also ran a free bus from the free store up to Morningstar, and so on that bus we would get all the LSD burnouts, or all the people, not all, but I mean there were also people who just wanted to come up, but if there was a person really having a bad trip on the sidewalk, the diggers would pile them into the bus and send them up. And so we were also functioning, I think, as a kind of a healing center. And I'm a great believer in nature therapy. I don't know if there is such a thing, but I mean a guy would show up at Wheeler's really alienated, and he wouldn't want to talk to anybody, and so he would go just sleep under a tree with his bag. Well, it gets pretty foggy like here and cold, so the next day he might get up and look around for a piece of plastic to drape over the tree branch, and so he'd do that. The next night he'd be a little more comfortable, and I'd see him a week later and he'd be smiling, and he'd be kind of relating to people, and he'd found a window that he'd propped up next to his plastic, and he was beginning to take some pride in the fact that he had a beginning of a little home. And I've seen over and over again how Wheeler healed people and brought them very gently back into the tribe without anybody having to do any formal type of consoling or counseling or whatever. And over and over again, the magic of nature is a great healing force. And it's one in which, in our culture, we've kind of packaged and isolated from our lives and created in, you know, little pockets for. Yes? Yes?
About children and when they homeschool, do they go to public school? Somebody had mentioned the Synod on Children and being a little uncomfortable or very uncomfortable later on. I don't know what has become of the children of the commune. So
well, I'm going to tell my one story, but then I think others may have better ones. And that is, one day I walked out on the land, and this girl, she was about 10, Michelle, was walking along with her sleeping bag on her shoulder, And I said, where are you going, Michelle? And she said, I'm really mad at my mom. I'm going to go and stay with so-and-so. And I thought, God, isn't that great? I mean, here, when a child has that freedom to, and it's totally in the safety of a large community of just opting out of her home for a day or two and going living somewhere else, you know? Now maybe some of you have others.
There's a lot about that on the film.
Yeah.
Mother of three.
at New Buffalo, where I was so many years in New Mexico, I mean, the kids, when they're at the house, they're getting the education of being around everything that's going on. I think it's very important to be in the public school, and the parents are involved with the public school. I think one of the problems with these communities is they, when they close the door and they just kind of stew in their own different kind of craziness, you're trying to be so radical already, it's good to keep your connections and say that we're not against this other community. We're trying to add something to the culture, but you can't reject everything, and you don't want to, because there's a lot that's good in the. And then I know we didn't have a TV, so our kid on the way home, he'd start at the Arianos and watch TV with their kids. You know, that's how you make community. It's very important to be involved with the community. How about this guy back here?
Yeah, in your personal feelings or opinions, what do you think is a more cohesive force, ideals or shared struggle?
Have we answered the question about children and communes first, and education? Have we answered the question about children and education first before? I like your question very much, but do you want to hear? Do you want to hear some more?
Yeah, no. Say what you.
Well, I have three kids, all raised communally, and they had different takes on the education that they received. The first thing at Bodega Pastures was six families got together and they all had kids. Mm-hmm. So we made a school. And my then husband and I lived in the school house. And when Sally Raspberry came to live with that community, she said, you guys promised that you would move out when we made a school. Now we're going to make a school. You've got to go. We had to go live under some redwood trees up in a different part of the land. My oldest daughter was very conventional, and she opted when Harmony School, the public school, was talking about having an alternative system in place, and she wanted no part of that. My son, he was just a nature boy, and he wanted the alternative. He wanted that so much, and my third daughter was looking at colleges, I was real enthusiastic about Bard and Evergreen. I took her to see those colleges, and she said, Mom, it's just like Star Mountain. You know? And she ended up going to Bryn Mawr College.
Yes.
But wait a second. Oh, Alicia
sorry.
Has something
We're still
to say.
Yeah.
I didn't have any kids, but I was very involved with two families that collectively had seven children that lived at the back of the land during those years at Wheeler's, when we were in that sort of wonderful sort of anarchic stage. The children learned to read on Zap and Snatch comics because they found them interesting and they liked the pictures. They took drugs, they played outdoors, they were involved in nature, and I wondered for years whatever happened to them, and finally when I put up my own website, one of them actually emailed me and put me in touch with all of the others. So I found out what happened to them. The one that contacted me said to me, you know, do you remember that day when we were all running down the hill with our arms out and we said we were flying and you went flying with us? And afterwards, you were holding yourself like this, and you said, when you grow up, don't have big tits, because then you can't fly. And I just want you to know that I grew very modest-sized boobs, Alicia. So I did influence her education in this way. But anyway, she when her family left Wheeler's, when the houses all got bulldozed, first they went to Whitethorn community in Humboldt County, and then afterwards they went to live in a small town in Texas where the dad got a job shrimp fishing, and the kids went to more conventional schools. But anyway, the follow-up, the oldest child is a nurse practitioner midwife, married, has kids in college. Her brother has a construction company. One daughter is married to the guy that trains the White Tigers in Las Vegas, and the one that contacted me is a special ed teacher and married to another special ed teacher, and they live outside of San Antonio. So everybody turned out very high functioning in spite of this sort of very free-form time that they spent during their elementary school years. And I think that it's largely a function of the fact that their parents were both very intelligent and interesting people and read to them and spoke to them. And I think that the quality of home life, regardless of whether you live, whether you're in a city or whether you're in a commune, is going to influence the kind of adult that you're going to turn out, whether you're going to really be interested in being constructive and seeking knowledge and being compassionate. And all of that, I think, is largely a function of the home. And also, their home not only included their parents, but other adults, including me. One day, I managed to get hold of one of those sacks of white flour that the winos didn't want, and I got together with the kids, and we made pretzels. But we just didn't make pretzels like this. We made pretzels shaped like people, and we made pretzels shaped like faces, and we made pretzels shaped like letters, and genitals, and that was what the kids wanted to make. But they were like, you know, it was time to do sculpture at the commune, and it was just kind of a natural thing. And out of that experience, I ended up working at a couple of alternative schools later in my life, just teaching art and writing and music for the kids.
Can we get back to now? Now let's go on to what's your name too?
Mitch Cummings.
Yeah. Mitch, yeah, might as well say your first name anyhow, folks. And Mitch, you were talking about idealism and conflict?
No, what's a more cohesive course? In the beginning, when you were talking, most of your talk was about the struggles.
Right.
And I'm wondering about if Mrs. Kelly and Mr. Kelly were more affable, say, having the situation happening on their adjoining property, and the local authorities came up and said, "Oh, maybe we can talk about a variance for the building code and things of that nature." You know, what's more cohesive for us, ideals, personal ideals, or shared struggle?
Well, there's such a thing as external enmity creates internal amity.
Yes.
Right? And I think a lot of the unitedness we felt at Wheeler's and Morningstar, some credit has to be given to the county. and the vibe was a little different. I mean, at Morningstar, Lou made a big point that the police were welcome. He said, "Everyone's welcome here, the police," and so on. And then, I mean, you know, it became quite apparent that the police felt quite comfortable there. In fact, there's a story of the naked cop who we finally did convince to take his clothes off, but it was off duty, and he did not last on the force much longer. But then, you know, by 1970, things had turned a little harder. I mean, there was a lot more conflict and confrontation in the larger society, and the folks at Wheeler's were getting a little teed off. There'd been a bunch of raids, the one that Felicia talked about, and there were others that were always thrown out of court. People would be arrested and taken in, and the judge would say there's no cause and drop the charges, and people would come back. But there was a lot of hassle, and the Kellys certainly did not make our lives any easier either. I lost the train of thought, but you get the idea.
Yeah, I think I don't see a conflict. But I think for the communities to grow, their idealism has to, I mean, you really are struggling to create the new culture, but you have to find ways of not closing that door. There's so many temptations to close the door and say these people are all bad. You have to meet them. I think Lou's you know, we were the same way too. We'd expect to get, when we traveled our caravan around the United States, we'd expect to be stopped by the police a couple times a day. And the same, you know, with the terrorism thing now, you're going to have to be open. You're going to have to, you know, and if somebody's arrested, then you're just going to have to find lawyers to help you and work it out and say, we're trying to be wholesome. We're not building bombs in the basement, and we're going to let you go in the basement to see. And, you know, so where you get in all these conflicts with the authority or the building people too, the offset of that is going to be your wholesomeness, is going to be your creativity, and really people saying, hey, these people are giving too much. They're the light of hope for our society. We have to help them. That's where you're going to get over these struggles, by doing the good works, by making them just shine so much, and the people being so beautiful, that's the way to overcome that struggle, not to get into a fisticuff thing and yelling at each other and then kind of slamming the door and we're getting ready for this revolution and not that revolution.
One thing I think should be mentioned was that Morningstar was bulldozed by the county at least 3 times. Other people claim 5, but I know definitely 3 times. And so the bulldozer would come in and wreck all the houses and leave, and then people would come back and build another shelter. And more people tended towards teepee living, because when the bulldozers arrived, you could fold your tent and kind of drift off. You know,
Deborah?
Yeah, I
went
to
Greenland
and Marlins costume for a second, because I just thought that was so compelling about, you know, thinking that the two camps, you know, the political camp living in the city and then the back to the landers. And I just know that when I did my interviews in the 60s Communes Project, one person really came to mind when you guys were talking about that, and that was Kat Ironwood. Maybe you all know her. Her parents started Equitable Farm in Mendocino County, and then she lived at Tolstoy Farm, and then she helped start Garden of Joy Blues in Missouri. And these were all back to the land places, but I think of all the people I met, she was one of the most political people. And so I just thought that my point is, I just met a lot of really hardcore political people living in these back to the land communes, mm-hmm. and that, so there wasn't really that much separation I saw between the urban folks and the back to the land folks. And it seems like maybe that's what you guys were saying too, especially Delia, when you talked about the eagle. But I think I saw more than just 2 arms or 2 wings to the eagle, and that maybe we need another metaphor of an animal that has more arms or something. I don't know.
Flying off.
Because another one I saw, and I saw many, but that really struck me were Roman Catholic nuns, and you know, all the reforms that were going on in Vatican II. But, I mean, they were all sort of a part of this too, and we don't normally think of that. But I don't know if you had any comments on that.
You know, I'll jump in just a minute. One of my things that I've come to think, I was involved with Camp Hurley near Woodstock, which was sort of leftist out of New York City, interracial. They leased this property. And one of the failings of the left, I think they were the startings, I mean, they should have bought that place and have it year round. And a lot of communities can have a day camp as one of their outreach things. And that's important. America offered people the chance, this American dream of having your own home, having your own family, and God bless people. I mean, you can't blame them sort of for going to that. But the community things got dropped. That's the Camp Hurley is an example. And then these communes that happened were not strongly enough supported by enough people. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why this leftist or progressive is so weak now in the United States, that we have very little influence and not finding our way, because these community things, you know, because they believe in community, and it has to come not from the government, though, it has to come from the people. This is the people's revolution. We've got the money now. We've got the prosperity. We have to embrace free enterprise and then put it together. They had a headline in one of these, you know, it's time to pay for the revolution ourselves. And And I think that that's so important with the left, and that's one reason why we ended up the way we are. And like I say, you can't really blame people, but it is, we have to put those community things back together.
Could I make a very quick reaction to say that in the leftist communities that I'm familiar with, there's an absence completely of spiritual rest. And I hear you using words like healing and, like a sanctification of life. You never hear that kind of discussion, and that's one of the great weaknesses of this, like, Marxist model.
There's a little bit of a difference on that. Rabbi Michael Lerner in Tikkun Magazine is exemplary in trying to bring together the spiritual and the political, and I recommend you to him, because it isn't just about Jews and Christians, it's about Jews, Christians, Muslims, and other groups. He's really quite a luminary.
How about this gal?
I wanted to go back a little bit to just the previous discussion about the county coming in and destroying the community. And I'm kind of struck by what you all think was the basis of that. I mean, there may have been specific incidents and specific laws that these communities came up against. But I'm just curious, why do you think there was such opposition?
Well, I think whenever
you have... Yeah. My base myself, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. I'd like to answer your question. Whenever you have a group of people with a brand new idea or way of life or thought come into an existing structure, you're going to have a tension. And what happened was there was a group of predominantly young people in their teens and 20s who came up to an established culture that was conventional. And they said, we're just going to live this way, you know, and they didn't, there was no conflict, I think, from the people who came in. They didn't come in and say, we're taking over your life. But that's how it felt to the people who came in. I think, you know, you just always have to deal with feelings. When you've got something going and you think it's the right way to live and someone else comes in and your children are looking at these other people and saying, hey, this looks like freedom to me and I want to go visit these people. And then you automatically say, no, they have the wrong way. This is not real freedom. This is mayhem and they're dirty and we raised you to keep your ears clean and look at these people, you know. So, you know, that's, I think.
Well,
wait a minute, let's leave it. Yeah.
And also, you know, we did have quite a spectrum of types of folks on the land, and there were people who shoplifted. Mm-hmm. There were people who were publicly drunk. Mm-hmm. And they did really piss off the families who were living in Occidental and Bodega Bay when they showed up and did these things. But then they would project that on all of us, and it was really only a very small percentage of us that behaved in those ways.
I think in terms of Morningstar and Wheeler's, there was in each case one neighbor who triggered the heat. At Morningstar, there was a back neighbor who was a retired, successful businessman who considered himself an expert on youth. And he was an unpaid consultant to the president of Sonoma State University. And when he looked across his back fence, his hair stood on end, literally. And he went to the county and said, this can't continue. And then he started a petition that went all through Occidental. And Lou was very hurt by that because people he considered his friends did sign. And when he asked the barber, why did you sign the petition, Louis? He said, oh, I don't know. I just did, you know. But, and in the case of Kelly, we were walking across his land. And he was, again, a conservative, retired businessman. And he was very upset for many years.
Wasn't there an easement, though? Didn't you have an easement?
The easement was not... Well, it was an easement.
Just for Bill.
The owner could drive, the owner could use the easement, but not his guests.
Well, that's the way it ended up.
Can I just add a little something to this? I think that maybe a hopeful and maybe not hopeful sign is that I think that the country today is very much divided between perhaps slightly more mainstream descendants of 60s communes and the ideals of that period, and people who are continue to be more conservative. And we see this, I think, clash of culture. I mean, you know, you might want to say red state, blue state kind of thing. But I think we still see this clash of cultures. Some people who want to sort of wander in the direction of 60s communes, not maybe go all the way, but wander in that direction. And people who go, who want to go, continue in the direction of perhaps your more conservative neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And still we have these people who see themselves as very oppositional and different from each other in the way they want to raise their families and the way they want their
this is happening. This is happening right now at Star Mountain Community. There's a group of people who believe that trash in your front yard is no big deal, and what is your problem? And people who believe that the meadow should be manicured and mowed regularly, several times a week. And these people are in major conflict and have divided the community right down the middle.
Well, one of the things also is that there is what I would call the vast center, where people who basically, vis-a-vis the 60s, accept what the 60s, my younger brother is very much, that's why I don't talk to him, an ultra-conservative, but people like my sister who accept what the 60s stood for up to a point, but they don't accept all of them. They would, for instance, say, yes, we needed to get over the rigidity of the culture, but we don't want to go too far in anything goes. We don't want to, like my sister, when she told me that she was willing to be, the thing is that the vast center was, I think, there's always been a cultural left and right in the country, but prior to the 60s, the cultural left was usually confined to things like university faculties, where even there you had to be careful, in many places you had to be careful what you said. Certain urban areas like San Francisco and so on. And the thing is that with the 60s, that particular culture began to break into the mainstream when it was green, and that created a lot of problems. Also, for instance, I talked to my sister a lot, and she's more.
Okay, but we're trying to get the panel to give.
I mean, trying to see is what about the vast,
What about the vast center? It's a good point.
Okay, yeah.
Because
did you have, sir, back there? Do you have a question?
I have another question. If you want to, if you want to respond to this first, fine. The question I have is in the area of ethics. When I think of the communities now that we're sharing about today, how did these communities determine what is right behavior and what is wrong behavior? What is moral and what is immoral? I know we all do that.
Alicia is going to answer your question.
Okay.
That determination as to what's right and what's wrong.
In an anarchist society like Wheeler Ranch, with a very interesting sort of leadership by Bill Wheeler, it was a matter of, are you harming? And the extent of the harm, what happened was Reagan was governor of California during that time, and he defunded the mental hospitals, and all of a sudden we had an influx of people that got expelled from mental hospitals, and one of them burned down Bill's house on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
One of them let go of the brake on the community bus so it totaled it and the community truck. There was another guy that was sitting in the chicken yard roasting a chicken one morning. I mean, you know, these guys, what Bill Wheeler did was he handed them, I don't know what amount of money, but he said, please go and don't come back. that was it. That was all the law that we had as far as right, wrong,
harmful or not harmful.
But you had to be really harmful before you were asked to leave, politely and with severance pay, as it were.
Was he always the final decision maker as to what was harmful?
Yes.
And what wasn't harmful?
Yes, he was. But for example, as an example of questionable activity that the community might have gotten divided over, there was a group of about four guys that lived on the knoll who were cat eaters. Yeah, there were cat. There were a lot of cats on the land, you know, and very easy to kill a cat. Here, kitty, kitty, boom, you know, and they would make clothes out of them, and well. Ew, you know, I mean, I a lot of us really were sort of nauseated by the idea of the cat eaters, and then the cat eaters themselves just went, well, there's too many cats and we're hungry, so what's your problem, you know? That never attracted Bill Wheeler's attention in the slightest. There was a commune that within our commune that came for a while that lived in the Oak Grove, where there were like, you know, a dozen women and they were, you know, sort of serially all having sex with the main guy, and I don't know, I mean, it was a sort of, you know, one of those scenes, and not a word was said about that. They came, eventually they left. That was sort of none of our business either, but, you know, when they started really wrecking things, I don't think there was ever an assault. I mean, it occurred to me much later that I had lived there as a teenage girl, naked, in a tent, and no one had ever, you know, tried to be inappropriately sexual towards me. All of my sexual experiences were ones that I welcomed. So that was really an interesting thing to think, because, you know, I mean, there were people that if I had seen them on a city street, I might have reacted with fear. They came from some really rough neighborhoods to Wheeler Ranch, but I didn't feel that. I felt like everybody was cool.
You know, about Oak Grove David that you mentioned,
yes.
this strange group, the first example of the community beginning to function without Bill Wheeler was the meeting that was called to deal with Oak Grove David.
Uh-huh.
And Bill, I think, intentionally left the land so the community could solve this problem on their own. Oak Grove David was kind of our mini Charles Manson, I would say, very many, but there was rumors that he'd killed somebody and buried them in the Oak Grove, and he began a definite attempt to take over the community, and so there was a meeting called. I wasn't there for it, but it was reported that it was decided that the community would trade the community bus to Oak Grove David for in return for his houses and for him to leave, and so OB, who was our resident Zen master, an elder, went to Oak Grove David and just put it to him. He said, this is a deal, and if you don't do it, there's going to be trouble. And so I think a day or two later, they packed up into the bus and left. But I think it was the first example of the community finally forming a head that was not Bill Wheeler and taking care of a problem. And I took it as a very positive sign that that in a very natural way, over a period of some years, the community was evolving a structure, not an imposed structure, but one that was coming from the heart that was going to be able to be a viable way for the community to solve its problems without the need for Bill Wheeler to play cop. I mean, what allowed Wheelers to work for a long time was Bill's willingness to play cop. Lou was never willing to play cop. We went to Lou and said, look, the winos were outside his cabin every night, building a huge fire, screaming, having knife fights, cutting each other up, and Lou wasn't doing anything. And so we had our one and only meeting that I ever attended at Morningstar and decided the winos would have to go. So then we went to Lou and said, Lou, you know, you're going to have to say it because you own the place. So you got to get rid of these guys. You know, they're really more of a nuisance. I mean, they're a nightmare. So Lou did go to the two or three worst ones and said, you got to leave. And Nevada said, well, they said, okay, it might take me a couple of weeks to get my stuff together. And Lou, the next day, claimed he had the headache and headaches that night, and weeping fits, and that he felt it was God telling them that he should never, ever tell anybody to leave. So they never left, but they did move down to the parking lot, and so the Wino camp, as it was called, was in the parking lot, and if you went to visit Morningstar, you drive in, park your car, and this sort of toothless guy would come up to you and say, can I watch your car for you? And so you'd hand him a $10 or a $5 bill and hope that your car would be there when you got back. But it became a small business for the winos in the parking lot, but it did get them out of the center area, and things did get a lot more peaceful. So, yeah, hold it.
I have a short question. Why is that most 60s communes were so short-lived?
Well, if you've been bulldozed three times, that does kind of tend to put a damper.
I don't know that they were all bulldozed.
No, they weren't.
I think that they were short-lived because people had an unrealistic idea of what it meant to live together. Mm-hmm. And so they had a brief flourishing, and they were flashes in the pan, and important flashes, lights for other people.
Amazing it worked as long as it did, as well as it did, I think. Actually, New Buffalo was 14 years, and this is still going at Delia's.
Well, do you really feel that, I mean, the media has lost interest in the communes, thank God, but if you buy a copy of the Directory of Intentional Communities, it seems to me there are still hundreds of intentional communities out there.
Yeah, but I think about the 60s communities.
Yeah, 60s.
Oh, the particular 60s communities.
They didn't take care of it good enough. The people, somehow they thought it was like the grass and the trees. It was just there. It was just amazing that it happened at all. I mean, it is a phenomenon that it's hard to explain.
I think that there was also something that had to do with our life transitions. That is, most of us came there in our late teens and early 20s, and we were before having children, or the children were just young and having they were having babies there. But as the kids got older, and the kids, for a lot of my friends, raising kids really necessitated access to public schools. The kids wanted more material things. The parents, therefore, needed to have jobs in order to provide those material things. So there really kind of was an exodus from the hippie lifestyle when parenthood really took hold. Not for everyone. I mean, Delia stayed in her communal life and raised her children there. Many people did. But I would say for a large number of people, there was an exodus to the more conventional life in order to give advantages to their children at a certain time.
One of the things that the person who has worked on advocacy with people with psychiatric disabilities is the people who were released from the hospitals. I mean, one of the things would be, I think, wouldn't it be possible to create some kind of alternative if Wheeler or somebody could not deal with them, wouldn't it be a good idea to have some open land for them where they could basically, whatever their problems were, they would not be locked up and they could be dealt with?
That's what Ramon said.
Yeah, well, that's the blowout center concept.
Sorry.
Actually, came out. I was involved with a communal organization that began in 68, and it still exists today. It still continues in its, all of its original sites, not its more branches.
Got it.
But I think that the reason why a lot of them didn't continue is because they don't have an economic foundation.
Yeah.
And so if they're structured to have some kind of session that you can do communally,
yes,
then
that's
you can
very
continue
important.
And then you can raise your family there, and you can have jobs within the community, and the commune itself can begin to provide those things that you want to provide for your family. So those people who
format, and it's still existing.
Well, that exactly defines the difference between the 60s communes and the communes that I visited today that have those long terms of residency to decide whether you can stay there, and most of them have, if not total sustainability, they have businesses that they do. For example, Lost Valley Education Center, a commune that has about 20 people living there, but they're built on an old summer camp, and during the summer, they host conferences and conventions there, mostly Buddhist and permaculture. But at that time, the commune changes into cooks and maids and administrative staff for these conferences, and then that's how they make some of the money that
and they have a magazine, and they have a land trust, and you know they're incorporated. So today's communes are way more sophisticated than the 60s communes in terms of
and also sustainability. From the early part of the century, also knew that they had to set up some kind of economic foundation.
This is not about California communes, but this has been raised 6 years ago when we went to the IPCC meeting in Germany. We stayed at one commune, went to three other communes, all of which seemed to have a very strong, or at least viable economic base. And I was curious to ask them if there are still alliance with the ones that we went to.
Jim, did you hear that? The communes in Germany?
This is very natural for me, that they construct it as a natural thing. When you were saying that you were doing something very new, did you feel like it was a new thing or an old thing? What was sort of the cult?
What did we know?
I personally felt like we were spontaneously trying to duplicate the lifestyle of the original inhabitants of those coastal hills. I mean, we were discovering wild plants that you could eat, and foraging for food in nature. Although we had our gardens too, but I think we had a higher and higher respect for the coastal Miwok and Pomo lifestyles. That's for sure. It would wiped out, of course.
We're down to a couple of minutes. Do any of you want to make any final observations or anything?
No, I like it.
Well, I like the conversation.
Okay.
What do you think?
Okay.
Well, I wanted to respond to her question and also kind of make a final comment. My younger sister is a psychologist, and one of the things that she believes in is something called bonding, which is physical closeness with emotional openness, and she felt that one of the great failings of modern society is a lack of bonding, and that is really truly the source of mental illness. So she felt, and I think that that's true, that a lot of what created the communal movement was a spontaneous desire for bonding, that we could be physically close and emotionally open with each other. And here I am with these friends that I've known for 35 years. They feel like my blood relatives when I see them. They're my family, and because we were all living together in this really intimate way, and I think that that is really one of the things that we looked for and that we found in living together in this way.
Thank you.
Time for lunch, and we need